The Acquest Podcast, Funds Industry Conversations.
Demystify funds regulation and jargon with the Acquest Academy. Tailored funds industry training programs to help you march up the learning curve. Hello podcast listeners. Welcome to the Acquest Podcast First 18 Special Series. First 18 is a special report that Acquest is producing for newly authorised fund management companies. It's called From Survive to Thrive, and it maps out the key challenges that a newly authorised fund management company is likely to face in the first 18 months, in addition to giving some tips and guidance and insight on how to navigate those challenges. To coincide with the publication of First 18, we're producing this special series of podcasts, and in each episode, we meet with an industry expert and go through one of the key challenges that a ManCo is likely to face, and provide some insight and guidance on what to do. Before we launch into the podcast, I wanted to let you know about a training event that Acquest is hosting on the 28th of June in the brand new business school in Trinity College, Dublin. It's called Funds Masterclass, and it's a one-day masterclass for Irish funds professionals providing key technical, regulatory and compliance training. We have a packed agenda of all things topical in our industry. We have a session on CP86, what to expect when you're being inspected, to help firms prepare for a central bank inspection on CP86. We also have detailed training on fund administrator outsourcing, depository record keeping and segregation, and then a session on financial stability and investment funds, looking at what all of that means for us. So if you're interested and you'd like to come along, check out acquest.ie and you'll find all the details for the agenda and how to sign up and get your tickets before they're all sold out. Okay, that's the housekeeping out of the way. Now let's crack on with the podcast.
The Acquest Podcast, Funds Industry Conversations.
Hello and welcome to the Acquest Podcast. This is our First 18 special series and episode 6 of that series, where we are going to look in particular at the legal challenges faced by newly authorised fund management companies as they work through their authorisation process and then their first 18 months post-authorisation. For this podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by two co-hosts from Maples. I have Peter Stapleton and Karen Killley. Thank you very much, guys, for joining me.
Thanks, Teddy.
Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Yes, thanks a lot. My name is Peter Stapleton. I'm the head of the Funds and Investment Management Group at Maples, and we've been advising a number of entities, as Danny's mentioned, either establishing new entities in Ireland or relocating existing business as a result of Brexit.
I'm Karen Killley. I am head of the Employment and Immigration Group in Maples, and I have been working quite closely with the investment management team in recent weeks in particular on the employment aspects of these matters.
In this episode, we're going to look at kind of some of the legal challenges that firms will face as they get themselves up and running. So, Peter, what is it like day one? You get the call from a client who has chosen Ireland as their domicile of choice post-Brexit, and they want to put the plan into action.
Yep, that's a good point. And exactly, Danny, as what happened in practice, we had a series of clients that would call us and they would probably be involved in an early stage and domicile selection type of entity. But as a very brief overview, the calls tended to work with the client, senior group from their teams, including general counsel, CEO, CFO, all of the different elements of the business. Because Brexit relocations and the repapering exercise we're going to discuss went far deeper for some of these organizations than, for example, a fund launch would go, where they had been used to using Ireland as a domicile. So we typically broke it up into three phases. And there was the management company or new Irish entity. Then we looked at the impact on the existing products, whether they were managed accounts, segregated accounts, fund product. And then we looked at the steps going forward, which typically worked on distribution, etc. So let's take the management company, for example. The UK, looking at the UK in particular, probably had a greater proportion of MiFID firms than we had in Ireland at that stage, who were either delegates of self-managed companies, and we'll discuss that structure as we go through some of the repapering exercise. But they, when they looked at moving, one of the initial repapering exercises we looked at is whether there was a benefit you could have in actually relocating. Because to a certain extent, Brexit just caused a negative impact on these entities. They looked at relocating entities from the UK who already had the European passports. So all you were doing was setting up a new entity in Ireland and possibly incurring additional costs and meeting the new EU rules, etc. So what we tried to do is speak to these entities as to whether there were perceived benefits in it. And one of the very common themes which came out was building an AIFM or dual authorised AIFM and UCITS entity, which could then manage a variety of products across it, and adding a MiFID top up to it. And what, where in that exercise we ran through whether the existing MiFID licenses they had in the UK were able to marry with the limited amount of MiFID activity you can add to an AIFM or a UCITS ManCo. And that included things like individual portfolio management, investment advice, and receipt and transmission of orders. So on the management company part, what we looked at the repapering and authorization exercise, you probably then had quite a substantive amount of project documentation. So we had the programs of operation or programs of activity that were required for the Central Bank of Ireland, and they quite differ from the UK FCA requirements. We built out that suite of documentation and tried to marry it to group policies. So on one hand, you've got quite specific fund documentation meeting, for example, the CP86 requirements, which will be quite different to the UK standards. But underlying that, you had a series of policies, for example, with MiFID II being a maximum harmonization directive, which we could use an awful lot of existing architecture to build those entities. And that's really where the companies faced their first real new challenge of relocating these entities, because when you dig through all of the legal documentation, sometimes the program matrix and the charts would run to 40 or 50 pages of small documents. So everything from the headline regulatory manuals right down to very small service level agreements, directors, service level agreements, employees, designated persons. So the documentation list became quite extensive after a while.
And so is that a big part of it then? You're taking, you're probably often cases not necessarily starting from a blank page, you're starting from group policies or group programs of operations, and you're kind of taking them then and adjusting them for the Irish environment. Is that
correct? Where we saw the real skill set was trying to replicate as much of the existing architecture. So what you weren't doing was creating a new entity in Ireland which was going to disrupt what people were doing beforehand. There was obviously good premise for doing that. UCITS, AIFMD and MiFID largely being the building blocks of this side of Brexit, if we're looking at the investment management and asset management world, they're very much aligned across Europe. So what we were able to do was take that and also, although the FCA rules and the Central Bank of Ireland guidance do differ, from a high level regulatory and policy perspective, there was an awful lot of overlap. So the skill there was for the legal teams to identify the parts that worked well together and to build out quite quickly the parts which were unique to the Irish market. So we needed to inform, in particular, the General Counsel and their team, what were the risks, what were they moving into Ireland, which would be governed under a very different premise, and how would that work? So that was one element of the project. And then, as you mentioned at the beginning, we're looking forward, and some of the listeners to this podcast will now actually have Irish authorised entities. So the next skill set was, when the legal teams have drafted all of that documentation and built it on the policies, how do you actually ensure that that is being looked at and being followed? So while the programs of operation and the programs of activity are quite detailed documents, so in many instances what you're filing with the Central Bank of Ireland is a 60, 80, even 100 page regulatory manual, and the bank, which I think to their credit, is very interested in not seeing just the high level principles, how are you meeting a UCITS or an AIFMD requirement, they actually want you to describe the process, who will receive the reports, where are these reports generated, who else has access to them, the amount of time commitment that people will spend managing that process. That leads to another level of the processes whereby now you're probably running compliance matrices or internal documents to ensure that they're kept. We've met several of the new boards of directors, because also, as Karen will explain later, the other element of this process was, while some staff did relocate to Ireland, you actually ended up hiring a brand new team in Ireland in many instances, or using in some cases secondees from third party service providers. And all of that had to be fit into an element of the new framework and ensuring they did what they said they were going to do. So running through, and for example, we look at just a very short sample of a documentation list. You had a program of operation, program of activity, depending on the type of entity. You had a remuneration policy, evaluation policy, a suite of documents covering everything from cybersecurity, outsourcing delegations, statements of responsibility, letters of confirmation, etc. The list of documents you repapered.
Absolutely. Possible. So that process to get to your authorization obviously is very involved. Do MANCOs tend to have all of that work done by the time the authorization comes through, or how much of it is left then? So the authorization has come. At what point are they looking at, updating prospectuses and contracts with service providers of the funds and that kind of stuff. Does that happen in tandem, or does that kind of depend on when the ManCo intends to kind of activate the authorization?
It's a really good question. So on day one, the entity must be substantially authorized and in place. So for example, the rules and the Central Bank of Ireland's requirements are that the manuals, the policies and procedures, but more importantly, the activity which supports what you're saying in the written format is ready on day one. So that's the good point. So some of those documents I just mentioned are all drafted in advance and finalized. Also, you need to have a business that is in existence before you take over the new management entity. So if we look at just a hypothetical example, let's use 29th of March, that was a good example. On the 29th of March, when you filed, most of the entities had to have a fully compliant management company and all of the policies and procedures in place, and would have at least a proportion of the business that they were transferring to Ireland in place. On day one, when the entity went live and got its authorization, as soon as the day after authorization, it would start actively managing, for example, an AIF, a segregated portfolio or UCITS. To your very good point, where there's a little bit of repapering or activity going on after that, is most of the entities that we advised have some form of ramp up, which is split into two parts. They would ramp up the management company themselves, so they would have a core team in place on day one. And the European regulators, including the Central Bank of Ireland, had to act in a commercial and pragmatic manner, ensuring that 100% of your human and technical resources were in Ireland on day one was difficult. So in some cases, what we have is a phased approach where the entities are working with maybe moving legacy group support and persons from the UK over to Ireland. So you might find that after the 29th of March, there's a period of 6 up to a maximum of 12 months where new team members are joining that entity, and assuming that, and for example, they might be accepting a handover from an external consultant. On the fund point, as you mentioned, the funds that they managed on day one had to be repapered in advance. So you would file, for example, the change of AIFM or the new distribution arrangements, new paying agent agreements. And we can come on to, for example, the registrations for sale of those funds under UCITS and AIFMD. But what you do have in this phase two is a transition of business. So again, most entities didn't transfer 100% of their fund range on day one, and they're now going through a process of gradually moving existing business over to Ireland. And what they will also do is, when new funds are launched, they will actually implement or use the new management company for that.
And did you see many firms kind of get to the point where they were cleared of comment with the regulator and kind of pause there before they activated the authorization, so that this piece about starting to transition and having your documents ready, kind of they pause before they let that kick in?
Correct. I mean, in an ideal world, and when we worked successfully with some groups, those groups who were very well organized and had looked at Brexit from a long way out had been moving both the management company and funds in the background. Having said that, it's sometimes quite difficult to align all the changes that happen exactly on the same business day. So again, I suppose the regulators being a bit pragmatic, you were able to get the management company cleared of comments and have a short period of time at which you were saying, we're now going to pass a series of resolutions or send out shareholder notifications. That being said, the clear direction from the Central Bank of Ireland was they didn't want to authorize entities on a contingent basis only. So they were looking for that period to be quite short. So it was commercially pragmatic. I think it helped some groups, but I think having a management entity which is basically sitting on ice, if we look at the current Brexit scenario, whereby we don't know whether it's going to be 1 June or 31st of October, I think there's a reluctance in the bank to leave the applications open that long.
Yeah.
So definitely most entities that we advised were up and running before the 29th of March, because that was obviously the hard deadline people were looking at, and a certain number will follow afterwards.
Yeah. So as we've been working with contributors and putting together the first 18 report, two key themes that we see again and again are people and recruitment, and then also about strategizing and making the business something that's going to be profitable and useful going forward. And that's something you touched on, Peter. I want to come back to that. But firstly, Karen, in terms of people and that side of getting the business up and running.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to, I suppose, to go back to one of the comments that Peter made about being ready for day one. Let's maybe dive down a little bit about the employment aspects of being ready for day one. And the experience that we have had over the past few months has been interesting, because we have found that some of the businesses that are coming inbound, while typically they will be bringing people over, say, from the likes of London, sometimes from the US, one piece that has on occasion frustrated the step plan or the timeline has been immigration issues. So it's not very common that it happens, and as of course everybody knows, it's been widely reported that the British and Irish governments have relatively recently signed a declaration which preserves the free travel and free movement essentially for UK citizens and Irish citizens. So in most typical situations, you don't have to worry about work permits or visas. But it's not a bad idea, certainly 3 to 4 months out before day one, to be thinking about that and thinking, well, actually, are some of my key team who are going to be coming here and activating this business and running it for me, are they EU citizens? Are they not EU citizens? And so just to have a think about that. It can take 6 to 8 weeks to get a work permit. It's not that easy to get a work permit. So these things do need to be considered. Then I suppose you move into a phase that's probably about 6 to 8 weeks out before day one. And again, we're drilling down into the employment aspects, not really the regulatory aspects, but there is some overlay between them. So what you need to be thinking at that time is you've identified your team, you've hopefully got your draft employment contracts or secondment agreements in advanced form, but you may be thinking about other things such as doing your IQ, helping to map out the various CF roles and PCF roles, and ensuring that in good time you're making your relevant applications to the CBI and giving whatever support you can to the candidates.
Yeah, of course the regulator is very hot in the fitness and probity regime anyway, but particularly now they've written to industry and they really want to make sure firms are putting forward the right people and constantly updating and monitoring what's happening and compliance with fitness and probity obligations.
Yeah.
So it's a bit more of an involved maybe a process than had been when it originally came in.
Quite right, and actually Peter and I have been working on that with quite a bit of intense frequency in recent weeks. There's absolutely a renewed focus on FNP, and it's no longer sufficient obviously to do those FNP checks at the outset and then sort of put it in a drawer and hope that it never raises its head again. We've been working with clients to put together policies that will ensure policies and processes really, because a policy is not sufficient. You need an active process that's going to trigger a review of F&P compliance throughout the life cycle of an employee.
And interviews are more common now. Interviews from the badges to come to the regulator and state your case is more of a common feature now.
Correct, absolutely. And there's some very interesting data publicly available from the CBI about that. And it's interesting how the interview of itself acts as a filter. So without necessarily having to go down the road of a formal exclusion or refusal, it is interesting to see that going through the interview with the CBI and the CBI perhaps sending either subliminal or very clear messages to a candidate that really their answers are not terribly satisfactory has seemed to act as sort of a filter for those who might not otherwise pass the process. So that's another interesting piece that we have had quite a bit of crossover on with the investment management team. The other piece that I would say then, I suppose the final piece in order to be ready for day one is just to have a think about the contractual arrangements that you enter into with your employees. Our experience over the past several months has been that there's a bit of a war for talent. We're a small, open country, but we don't have a huge population. And so the pool of talent is, I wouldn't say it's limited, but it's definitely small. We're not a city of London where we don't have that scale. And while we have good talent here, there's certainly competition for it and there's war for it. So from the pure, again, employment law perspective, there's a couple of devices or there's a couple of things that you can think about stitching into your contract, which A, incentivizes your talent to stay with you, and B, should your talent decide to move somewhere else, and in particular to a competitor, that you don't risk any of the key assets of your business, such as your other employees, your confidential information, your client relationships. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is paying careful attention in the contract of employment to things like notice provisions. Like, is it enough to have a 1 month notice period for somebody senior? Probably not. We would say 3 to 6 months is a more practical duration. think about post-termination restrictions. So from my own perspective, I've supported clients over the years who have gone after employees or teams who have moved to other businesses and who have taken with them client lists, confidential information, and other company property. And that can be really super damaging, because as Peter has outlined, there's a huge volume of work that needs to be done to get ready for day one. You don't want that walking out of the building. So that's another piece just to bear in mind, and maybe to discuss it with your lawyers as to how best you can protect the business in the contractual arrangements.
Now, if podcast listeners would like some tips on easier ways to try and hold on to your staff, in the second of our series, we talked to Jennifer Cahill of Savvy Recruitment Consultants, and she had some hints and tips for ways that you might retain staff through flexibility and other kind of arrangements and stuff like that. So hopefully you won't need recourse to your contractuals.
Exactly.
Something to think about anyway.
Exactly, and stitch it in, but yeah. Absolutely. Incentivizing and providing flexible practices. And as you may be aware, we've had some reasonably radical overhauls of parental leave and paternity leave benefits in Ireland, which are due to come on stream very shortly.
Does that surprise promoters who might be coming from somewhere where those rules are quite a little bit, quite a lot less onerous on an employer? So, for example, if you had a promoter from the States, might not be used to 6 months of maternity leave and that kind of stuff.
Correct, yes, there would be quite a difference. I mean, obviously I'm not a US employment lawyer, but I would have an awareness that the leave, the sort of family-related leave provisions are a lot more generous here. It's not so much of a distinction compared to the UK, for example, or other continental European jurisdictions. A lot of the leave entitlements in any event derive from European law, so it shouldn't be too much of a difference compared to what they are ordinarily used to.
And then, Peter, in terms of sort of looking down the tracks where we're at in the regulatory cycle, and you have your man co-authorised and you've done all the things you needed to do and you've staffed it up and you've kept your promises to the regulator and you're up and running, what kind of new legislation, that kind of stuff that's coming down the track, is there anything there to be especially worried about?
Well, hopefully we'll get a little bit of a break from the legislation. I mean, immediately on day one, so again, if we look back to that point you mentioned, you've got your authorization. The initial flurry of activity is now the entity is live, is looking after things like the repapering of passporting provisions to actually sell the funds into new jurisdictions. Because while you can pre-notify in some instances, most of it can only take place once the entity is authorized. So with that, you've got your management company in place, you've repapered your funds with regard to disclosures of the new entities, and now you've registered for distribution. What's coming down the track? Well, you know, we have some domestic movements in UCITS in Ireland with the UCITS regulations being published. There's the long-mooted AIFMD 2 review. I think MIFID is undertaking a review, but there's nothing substantive from a legal and regulatory point of view which is going to require those entities to completely repaper their agreements. So that's good news for people who've undertaken this process. What we hear from the Central Bank of Ireland, and again, I think they've been transparent on this process, is the repapering or going forward, the body of work might be a little bit for those entities who pre-existed Brexit. So what we've had over the Brexit process is the bank had CP86. You were heavily involved, Danny, at your time there.
Indeed,
in
yeah.
this. And to be fair, and to credit you and the Central Bank of Ireland, we saw an awful lot of the DNA of CP86 in the ESMA sectorial opinions, and there seems to be a commonality of thinking at the European level as to what these entities should do. What was, I think, a little bit different and is going to impact on those existing entities, so entities who were in Ireland that had regulated activities and nothing that they're doing is directly connected to Brexit, is that the Supervisory Convergence Network seems to have some specific ideas about substance, time commitment, etc., which I think are new, and they have been addressed with applications that have run over this Brexit time and have now gone live on the 29th of March. However, for entities in existence who implemented CP86, they probably don't have quite the same level of substance currently in place. Will the bank look at that? Will it try and equalize management companies that are previously in existence versus those that are newly authorized? And we also have, for a very successful element of the Irish market, the self-managed fund. We have to see whether, for example, the way that those funds have been organized, which historically has been completely on par, the regulatory manuals, the programs of operation, the governance of those entities. We have never had an issue with a client that runs a self-managed fund. So we're very, very happy with those entities. And we would robustly defend that model and the way that they're run to date. That being said, there is a discussion in the marketplace and some indication that a self-managed fund may now need to look at the levels of controls, oversight, and substance that are going into some of the management companies. And will that mean, for example, those entities have to increase the time commitments of their existing designated persons, or will we see a shift, which previously in Ireland was quite unique? We had a heavy instance, particularly in the UCITS market, of self-managed companies. AIFMD was a little bit different. People were establishing AIFMs. It was a separation of fund and AIFM, less of these internally managed AIFs, as I refer to that directive. But we've seen a shift now versus promoters and sponsors using management companies to run multiple AIFs, multiple UCITS. And that review of the self-managed investment company might prompt a further shift in that direction.
Yeah, I think it's probably reasonable to think that the regulator will look back at the firms, the Mancos and self-managed funds that are there prior to the Brexit flow of companies coming through. So that's definitely on the agenda and on the horizon, and probably the next wave of reviews and firms that are going to start to do, looking at how they're organized and what have you.
Completely correct. And I think, you know, with that, it's still an intensive time for law and regulation. But I think those entities, the nice thing about the repapering exercise, particularly for those who've just gone through it, is you have the latest version. You have, you know, Brexit 2.0 or 3.0, wherever we are now. So I think for those entities who've just gone through the process, they can thankfully, you know, take a sigh of relief. Those large projects are over. And there's some nice stuff coming down the line for those managers who want to embrace ESG. There's some developments at European level as well. But I think it might now be a concentration back on the business. Repapering in advance of that with some minor Irish changes, I don't think is going to be extensive for the market. And then just to echo what Karen has seen, the only thing we're aware of is there will be a focus on those entities. There may be some minor repapering as a result of, I understand from the comments of Stephen Mayor and ESMA, that ESMA is going to take a review of the national competent authorities and the regulators. That's likely to have an effect on a feed-through of comments that ESMA discovers on the authorization processes, maybe in Ireland. So we might see elements towards the end of the year where that ESMA peer review has uncovered a couple of elements that they'd like to see harmonized across Europe. So don't discount that yet. The other thing as well is I fully expect, with such a volume of entities authorized by the Central Bank of Ireland in a relatively short period of time, I do think that some of the normal due diligence and visits that the Central Bank of Ireland would conduct anyway with these entities, or indeed inviting in the CEO and designated persons to discuss the operation of those, I wouldn't be surprised to see some of those meetings take place this year. And again, to the point we've discussed beforehand, I don't foresee a repapering of policies, but I think there will be a focus, as Karen put it, on the process. So I think for those entities that have now have nice, shiny new regulatory manuals and a suite of new fund documentation, it is very, very important that their teams are focused on actually implementing what they said in those policies, because I think there will be a zero tolerance approach to finding entities who've received new licenses in Ireland on the basis that they said they would do X and then not carrying that through.
Yeah, so there certainly will be plenty for new fund mancos to do day two to make sure that they're delivering on the promises and commitments that they made during the authorization process. So I just wanted to wrap up on this. As we've gone through putting together First 18, a common theme from contributors is this real passion that these new management companies aren't just compliance costs, that they develop into businesses that really add to the bottom line. And we've seen from other contributors of podcasts where they've highlighted they need to strategize and make sure you have a plan for how you're going to use this Manco to do that. Are you seeing that being an important part of the, I suppose, the pre-authorization bit, the sort of the structuring piece?
Completely correct. I mean, even when we talked at the beginning of this podcast, was strategizing on day one, was looking at transferring the MiFID entity in Ireland. Did you add some additional permissions to it to make it a more enhanced entity? The growth of the hybrids, the dual authorized AIFM UCITS with MiFID top-up, now gives entities as close to a management company which can operate across AIFs, UCITS, and segregated accounts. So they've been very important. Some are using a differentiator. While a large sector of the market moved early to address Brexit, and the vast majority of our clients, indeed all the applications we were working on, were completed by the 29th of March, there's a substantive amount of entities still in the market hoping maybe Brexit will go away. So from a strategy point of view, the earlier adopters who've taken some of this pain with the repapering and project exercise, they're now able to go out to their investors and say, no, we have secured an entity, our licenses will be unaffected, we are now, for want of a better word, Brexit proof. So that strategy element of ensuring that the Irish entity is now a benefit to the group as opposed to just purely moving cost centres from the UK to Ireland, or indeed for a global promoter having not gone to Ireland, gone to the UK but gone to Ireland instead, is very important. The key issues, as we always see with the Irish environment, are good. We know that the cross-border marketing directive, which is coming down the line, is going to further enhance distribution of funds through Europe. Ireland will be a key player in this. The corporate tax regime is very good. As Karen mentioned, the pool of talent, while it is currently not very deep, it is wide and growing all the time. We now do see as well senior executives coming back to Ireland because they now have the option to run these entities. Also, and a personal view of mine, which is very, very interesting, is two themes could prove a unique benefit. So we have a huge move into the fintech and blockchain space. Ireland has an enviable cluster of the largest technology firms in the world, whether it's Apple, Facebook, Twitter, etc. Not only are they producing huge amounts of services in Ireland, but they're also having spin-off. They're having small affiliates or employees leave. So I think the development of technology in Ireland, plus the world-class administration service moving into, for example, blockchain, is very good. And then the second theme I touched on was ESG. Ireland is quite lucky, and we've been chasing that ESG agenda for some period of time, both at Irish funds level and at a group called Sustainable Nation. There are serious moves to position us as a global centre of excellence. So those entities here can buy into that. And Ireland has some very important deals and large projects which have happened. For example, the World Bank issuing an ESG bond yesterday, and the government withdrawing from funding of all fossil fuels. So I think that those two spaces, which are going to affect the asset management industry across the board, might be areas that new Irish entities can also focus on.
And so ends Peter's party political broadcast on behalf of the Irish funds industry and the Irish economy generally. And so ends our podcast. Thank you very much, both of you, for your insights and your contributions. Very much appreciated. Thank you, podcast listeners. This, as I said, was episode 6. Episode 7 shall be out next week, and that will be the last in our series of podcasts to coincide with the launch of First 18. You can check out the Equest.ie website, where you'll be able to register and get your hands on a copy of the report as soon as it's available. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Thanks, Danny.
Thanks, Danny.
Equest Academy demystifies funds regulation and jargon, helping you march up the learning curve. If you want to see how good we are at what we do, apply for free in-person 45-minute masterclass. Check out Equest.ie for more details.
The Equest Podcast, Funds Industry Conversations.